So I greet you with the most ancient of greetings of our community, which is grace and peace. Gracia y paz. So we just shared a Eucharistic celebration, and that's a time for us to remember we're family with each other, with every other member of the Catholic community in the entire planet, and even more, and mysteriously, with all those that have gone before us. And that now, although they're no longer sharing our home on the planet, they are sharing with our life in a different home. And that's the home that Jesus told us he would prepare for us all. So I like to begin by asking us to be open to the Holy Spirit in our midst. And we don't have to ask the Spirit to join us, because the Spirit's already here. We just have to make ourselves open up to the Spirit and being receptive, right, to what God continues to pour into our reality. And God needs us to feel rising within us. So we're going to start our time together by asking what may appear to be a simple question, yet one you may not have taken time to consider before. And as I want you to just kind of get a little bit in your head, as you made your plans to be here, you cleared your schedule, you packed, you made sure you locked all the doors, and you turned off all of the beeping things. Check that out right now. You did so we could all be together for a few days. And did you ask yourself why? Why did you come to the summer conference? What motivated you to be here? So I'm going to give you a few minutes to just go inside. Write down some thoughts. Why did you come to the summer conference? Like I do with my students, I will time you. Okay. So your answers may be very practical and personal. It's a tradition with us. It feels like coming home. I love the friends and the community. It nourishes me. I want you to notice your answers. But now I want you to tweak the question a little, but keep your same answers. Everybody got it? Keep your answers, new question. Okay? And let's see how these fit with the new question. Why do you want to be church? Now, notice that I don't say, why do you want to be part of the church? Because the church isn't something that we're a part of. The church is something we are. We simply are. So just like the conference, the community who constituted by coming together and serving each other for a common good, without it, there's no conference. So we are the conference. We are the church. Now, the church is not an institution, but a way of being. And so I want you to look at your answers again or think about them. Don't change them. Do they also answer the question of why do you want to be church? Can I see a show of hands? Do they answer the question when you look at it of why I want to be church? Okay. So what this tells me is that you have a pretty healthy sense of what it means to be church. So let's look at one possible answer. It's a tradition with us. Absolutely. Today, most theologians like me rarely refer to religions or denominations. We prefer to say tradition, as in the Catholic tradition. And I like this because it makes us aware that a religious tradition is something complex. It exists within a culture and that it is, or at least it should be, part of daily life and passed along from generation to generation. Yet we've gotten some things very, very wrong about our Christian tradition during some periods of our history and in some regions of our world. So let's use our experience with this conference to interrogate, right, the idea of passing along the Catholic tradition. So just imagine for a moment that you have been forced to be at this conference against your will only because a parent said so. Or that your family was only nice to each other during these few days at the conference, but once you left, they just fought and judged each other. Imagine that those gathered at the conference used their attendance here to feel superior to others, to condemn others, or to exclude them. I guarantee you that if that had been your experience of this conference, you wouldn't be here today. You would have walked away from this tradition. Well, that's the experience of being church many people in this country, young and not so young, have had. And what I just described has been the actual experience, verbatim, of being Catholic of many of the young people I work with. In the United States today, the number of people who have completely walked away from all religious traditions, what demographers call nuns, is twice the size of the entire U.S. Catholic population. Even more alarming, the majority of today's religiously unaffiliated people, I mean the largest number of them, were once Catholic. And as they leave, these former Catholics are heartbreakingly but accurately often referred to as duns. And one important footnote here, these numbers do not represent Catholic experience in many other parts of the world. So our first question of why we want to be church has to take this account into reality, right? Which starkly communicates the possibility that many Catholics in the United States have not asked themselves this question. If we don't begin here by asking ourselves honestly what in our life experience has called us to be church, our faith will be fragile and may crumble in the face of what is difficult. If we want to engage with a world that needs us, we need to reliably ignite and sustain our motivation for such an engagement. And that all of us here identify as Catholics gives us a powerful foundation and a common ground for our long-term motivation. I would say that we are what Latino theologians call comprometidos. That we use the same word of being a person committed to a faith that does justice, that is used for being betrothed, tells us a lot. Just like a marriage, a grown-up faith centered in engagement with the world's suffering needs to be discerned and built on solid ground. I think of civil rights leader Cesar Chavez, himself a very comprometido Catholic, who said it best. It is possible to become discouraged about the injustice we see everywhere. But God did not promise us that the world would be humane and just. God gives us the gift of life and allows us to choose the way we will use our limited time on earth. It is an awesome opportunity. So let me ask you now to spend a few minutes, 5 minutes here, with this more precise question. Okay. Why do you want to be church? And I have to admit, I was relying on people having things to write on. I'm too used to a classroom. So we may just do much shorter time for this. But I want you to think about, why do you want to be church? What is it in your life experience that calls you to the Christian gospel and to living it within a Catholic community? What lit a fire in you? And what keeps it going? Okay, that's the question. I want you to just spend a couple minutes on that. Yeah. Right? It may have been a hard question. And that's because what we're doing right now is the work of theology. So, theology is an action. It's something we do. And imagine that we worked at a sushi restaurant. Okay, I really like sushi. And we would be really clear that we had a task before us, and that task would be to make sushi. Well, as theologians, we also have a really precise something that we make. And now, I know some of you are going to say, wait, I'm not a theologian. And I will say to you, yes, you are. You may not be a professional theologian like me, but you are a theologian. Because you are involved in the action of wrestling with your communal faith from your particularity and then generating some insights for the good of the community. And that's what we make. Theologians make insights, not sushi. So I want you to look down at your notes now so far this morning. Do you see insights there? Did you make some insights? Let me see some hands. Did you make insights? Did you make insights? Okay. So how many people here then are theologians who just generated some insights? Beautiful, right? So my fellow theologians. We're gonna devote a few minutes now to hearing some of the insights you generated. And again, you know, I'm gonna cut a little bit of the time on that. But here's the variation to what we're gonna do, because we're a church. We wanna embody what it means to be church by always being for and with others. And so I don't want you to give me your insights or your answers. I want you to give us what you heard from your partners. What insights did they give to you? Because sharing the fruits of our discernment is a gift. Okay, so we're going to take a few minutes. Some of the insights made by the people you spoke with, you dialogued with, what did you hear? Yes?
That following tradition, especially maybe that of a mother, even if it's just following, can lead to understanding and opening to a peace. Like, if my mom is at peace in her death because of her faith, then it's good enough for me, kind of.
Beautiful, beautiful. Great dish, right? Great dish. Who else generated some insights? Yeah.
I had an insight from my daughter who really resented it in her high school years that she couldn't go to the keynote speech because the high school class was not enough. And it's because the church offers the wisdom and understanding of what life is all about, the meaning of life. And that's so valuable and so important that young people especially, they want that so bad. And if they have a sense of where they can find it, they want to go after it. And that is something that we need to encourage.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Anyone else want to share another insight you heard from? Yes.
The discussion was the longing for ritual rhythm in the community. It was anchoring for this person and mm-hmm. helped navigate difficult times. But it was combined. It was community mm-hmm. ritual, the rhythm of the year, the rhythm of the liturgical year.
Okay. So we already generated some very cogent, coherent, thoughtful ways to think about how it is we do this work of being church. So I'm going to recap right now, okay? We dug deep and asked ourselves why we're here, why we wanted to be church, why we wanted to make a compromiso, a commitment and promise to embodying the Christian gospel. We started generating some insights. We should act as sparks anytime we need to relight our fire. We have begun a process that, if it works correctly, will keep us engaged in using our limited time on earth, as Cesar Chavez told us, with a sense of the awesome opportunity this presents us. So with that fire lit, we want to involve ourselves in the task of a particular type of theology, which some of us today call political theology. Now, political theology has nothing to do with political parties, and even less with partisanship. What it has to do with is how the task of being church was defined by Jesus and his friends, was revised by the Second Vatican Council, and it's newly on fire with our Pope Francisco. So let's start with how Jesus understood himself. There's a place in the scriptures where Jesus uniquely defines himself, and he does so in reference to his own theological tradition. So let's take a look at that scene. And this is from the Gospel of Luke chapter 4. He came to Nazareth, where he had grown up, and went according to his custom into the synagogue on the Sabbath day. He stood up to read and was handed a scroll of the prophet Isaiah. He unrolled the scroll and found the passage where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because God has anointed me to bring glad tidings to the poor. God has sent me to proclaim liberty to captives and recovery of sight to the blind." So, to let the oppressed go free and to proclaim a year acceptable to the Lord. Now, Luke's story is very evocative, but unfortunately, we tend to spend way too much time with the next section about the people of Nazareth rejecting Jesus and forget that this reading of the scroll and what it says is the most important part of that story. Jesus is here telling us how he understands his own calling. He's answering the question, why am I here? The sacred scriptures are the core of our religious tradition because they were at the core of how Jesus understood the world. And this passage from Luke tells us much the evangelist wanted to communicate. First, Jesus is in continuity with the Jewish tradition and its teachings. Jesus is looking back at Isaiah for guidance, and we are looking back at both of them to help us answer our own questions. Second, in Jesus, and the way he understands God's purposes, the promises of God are being fulfilled. And third, the church embodies a serious and relevant religious tradition. Remember, Luke was gathering the preaching of early Christians, women and men, who were going out into the world to continue Jesus' mission. They all want to make clear that this is not an intellectual exercise or one of the many mystery cults of the time. This was fidelity to the God of Israel. And God's vision was to love and heal the world. So let's tease this out a little bit more, because the preaching that the Gospel of Luke passes on to us is very purposeful. First, Jesus is not inventing a religious tradition. He is embodying the faith of his ancestors in the world in a way that responds to the needs of that world. Second, in Jesus' words and deeds, God is revealing God's self. And third, that revelation must be relevant and transforming for the world. But wait, why is Jesus asking these questions about what he should be doing and why? What's going on in his life? Well, we need only look at the beginning of Luke chapter 4 to get the answer, right? Because after Jesus is baptized, he's intentionally entering a period of discernment. And Luke describes it as Jesus being led by the Spirit into the desert. It seems he was out there alone and following the lead of really extreme asceticism of John the Baptist and his community. So Jesus has taken the first step, but now he needs to find his way to God and to seek God's vision for God's creation. The young man from Nazareth, spending many days in this process, appears hungry, lonely, and exhausted. And in such a challenging space, right, the voice of the Spirit that was guiding him seems to get crowded out. And Jesus starts hearing other voices that the scriptures call the devil and the temptations. And if we put aside that we're dealing with a text that is so ancient that our minds can't possibly conceive of a time span of 2,000 years, and we just look at the very human story the text is telling us, we're going to find we have a lot of in common with Jesus. So the chaotic voices that arise as he searches for God are the kinds of things that could really mess up our answers as to why am I here and what am I called to do. The first is our desire for comfort and security. Something none of us should cling to if it keeps us from doing the work we need to do. Second is giving up control and realizing that human power very often comes with corrupting strings that make doing the work God needs doing almost impossible. And third, this is the ultimate temptation in human self-glorification, to test God, and in this way to limit God to being a God of the gaps, who only shows up by reversing the laws of nature. This is a comic book God or a movie God, sweeping down only when we call on God to do so, but who demands nothing of us. This is us controlling God, and it's a deadly illusion. The time Jesus spends in the desert is really a time for him to face down human weakness as he struggles with hunger and as he accepts his lack of control and his dependence on God. This is when Jesus faces all of this, and then he refuses the easy way out. And this is how he discerns his why. In the synagogue, with his community, and with the guidance of the scriptures, he begins to see clearly. This is Jesus giving us his job description. And if we're Christians called to love as he loves, this is our job description too. as he sheds what would cloud his vision, Jesus gets clarity. God's vision for creation is not theoretical in Jesus, and he will repeat this in every way he can in his life. Feeding, healing, freeing. And so now it's our turn, and that's the work of the church. In 2 millennia and in an incredible variety of circumstances, we have sometimes been attentive to the priorities Jesus left for us, and at other times we've worked against them. In modernity, the Catholic Church has had two major moments of discerning why we want to be church and where the Spirit is leading us. The first was 60 years ago. The second is today. And these two moments are linked. So first, let's take a look at the last document of Vatican II, Gaudium et Spes, the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world, which proclaimed in 1965. Never has the human race enjoyed such an abundance of wealth, resources, and economic power, and yet a huge proportion of the world's citizens are still tormented by hunger and poverty, while countless numbers suffer from total illiteracy. Never before has humanity had so keen an understanding of freedom, yet at the same time, new forms of social and psychological slavery make their appearance. Although the world of today has a very vivid awareness of its unity and of how one human depends on another in needful solidarity, it is most grievously torn into opposing camps by conflicting forces. For political, social, economic, racial, and ideological disputes still continue bitterly, and with them the peril of a war which would reduce everything to ashes. True, there is a growing exchange of ideas, but the very words by which key concepts are expressed take on quite different meanings in diverse ideological systems. Finally, humanity painstakingly searches for a better world without a corresponding spiritual advancement. Influenced by such a variety of complexities, many of our contemporaries are kept from accurately identifying permanent values and adjusting them properly to fresh discoveries. As a result, buffeted between hope and anxiety and pressing one another with questions about the present course of events, they are burdened down with uneasiness. This same course of events leads people to look for answers. Indeed, it forces them to do so. In many ways, Gaudium et Spes seems like it was written yesterday. My undergrads, I show it to them without telling them the year, and they think it was written yesterday. And it calls us out of isolation, out of thinking that the role of the church is simply to perpetuate itself as an institution, and back to our very roots in that synagogue with Jesus. And section 4 concludes, we the church must therefore recognize and understand the world in which we live, its explanations, its longings, and its often dramatic characteristics. Now, somebody who took this very seriously was the theologian Johann Baptist Metz, who went in search of insights about what disengagement with the modern world might look like for us. And in 1968, he wrote Theology of the World, which introduced the idea of political theology. And Metz's main idea, and one which provides the roots for what we're doing here in these next few days, is that the deprivatizing of theology is the primary task of political theology. What the council had sought to do was to bring the church back to its original task of engaging the suffering world. Or as Metz put it, to actualize the critical potential of faith in regard to society. And most church historians agree that in the more affluent parts of the world, the Second Vatican Council documents were put away with little implementation, at best forgotten, and at worst suppressed. But they bore much fruit in the global south, and especially in the meeting of CELAM, the Episcopal Conference of Latin American and Caribbean Bishops, which brings together 22 different countries. And Gaudium Espes had hoped to send theologians out to work from inside the spaces that were closest to where people first experienced the gospel and the people who first wrote the gospels, among the poor, the oppressed, the exploited. So the Church of Latin America took up the challenge. And I believe we're almost out of time, so we will take this up, this challenge, tomorrow. Have a great rest of the day.